regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of ditto.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe a citizen's hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The model of the citizen hearing is if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, the countdown to disclosure. I'm very happy to have you here today. I want to give you an update on the White House petition that I started on March 23rd. Yesterday, when we began the program, we had 148 signatures. Today, we have 457. That's a pretty big jump. I'm happy with that. Of course, you all know I want 100,000 signatures. So thank you all for your efforts of getting the word out. And please continue to send this petition to the media. I want to read the petition to you. It says, "Respectfully, we the people request President Obama disclose the truth about NSA astronauts who landed on the moon, 1961. After NASA landed in 1969, only the NSA flights, with the help of negative ETs, were allowed to continue. NASA has thrown off the moon, was thrown off the moon by both negative ETs and NSA, and told not to come back. That's why we never went back. The secret space program uses an academy across the highway inside a mountain in Colorado. The real NSA astronauts fly the ultra-top-secret TR-3B, Aurora, and other anti-gravity-equipped craft like the Shark helicopter. The fourth, fifth-generation anti-gravity quantum effects craft make routine flights to the moon and Mars as often as weekly. Self-disclose the truth about our government engaging with extraterrestrials from our president to her citizens. This information was given to me from a very high-ranking source, and I know it's true. There was a post out on Godlike Productions yesterday, and it reads in capital letters, WTF? Did the NSA tell NASA to GTFO the moon? And then it has a link to the petition. This is exactly the exposure I wanted to get. These young kids who are interested in all the ufology stuff, they're not reading the New York Times and the Washington Post. The other reason I wrote this petition was the We the People website has a policy that if something violates what they feel is Homeland Security or some other Department of Defense or something in the government, they'll drop the petition. They'll disallow it. And by making such a brass statement that could be thrown out as being nonsense, it kept the petition up there. So the ones who know it's true are choking when they read it. And the ones who wonder if it's true are laughing at it. So it's pure beauty. And the whole point of the petition is not for the White House to comment on the question. We know the answer to the question. NSA was there 8 years before NASA was there. We know that. Everybody knows that. That's not the point of the petition. The petition is to dare the media to start to speak about the citizens' hearing on disclosure. I dare them to. I want to see it on the front page of the New York Times. I want these kids who are not posted on Godlike Productions, I want their parents to read it on the front page of the New York Times. And that's why I need more signatures. So thank you for all your help. So today what I'd like to do is get back on our schedule of events of spotlighting and featuring the witnesses that will be at the citizens' hearing for disclosure at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., April 29th to May 3rd. And today we're going to have Gary Heseltine. He is a U.K. researcher. He was in the police force in the U.K. for many, many years, and he documented cases of police sightings of UFOs. But now he has evolved into being one of the U.K.'s greatest researchers on UFOlogy, and we're going to hear a little bit from him. Gary's website is prufopolicedatabase.co.uk. And if you want more information about that, you can go look at galacticroundtable.org. There's a lineup of hosts, and Gary's on there, and it takes you to the link that has all his bio and information there. He's a very dynamic speaker, very interesting. Let's take a listen to what he has to say.
But it will give me the time to do more active research and pursue.
This is Gary speaking on a radio program called Planet X in the UK.
Areas that I wanted to do for a long time. So, yeah, that's something I'm looking forward to. And whilst I won't say anything at the moment, that I've got plenty of ideas that I've discussed with various people, including this radio show, about the way we go forward with British ufology and world ufology to an extent.
Exciting times. Of course, Grant, I caught yesterday's talk, but I missed, and Jackie missed the end of the show. But, Steve, you were telling me a little bit about it. It was the whole disclosure that was going to happen, but then didn't happen?
Well, the idea is that I've had it for a number of years is what people may not know is Chase Brandon says he's written a book, is a CIA officer, and he says, when you read my book, make sure you read between the lines and you may get something. So you've written, what they do is they put out a fictional story. The real story is inside of it. They want the story out, but because they've wrapped it in the fiction, nobody can tell what's real, what's not real, and they are indirectly telling us the story of what's going on without it getting out of control and without releasing any classified information. So if they're talking about aliens, they won't describe exactly what the alien looks like or the ship or whatever, but they will basically tell the story. So I went through and I ended up in, as Gary said, 1994. I didn't even get to the end. All these stories of how many times they've done this. They've been doing it since the 1950s. CIA dressing up as Air Force officers to go get film because they don't want anybody to know the CIA's into it. And just bizarre stories that over and over again they've done this. Put the story out, pull the story back, and go to the sort of the company policy. We're not involved. We're not interested. And then you see these people. Well, if you're not interested, why are you approaching people with movie films and talking to people? It's very evident that the American government is extremely interested in what's going on, and they are talking to researchers and releasing material to tell the world what has actually happened since 1947.
Now, of course, it's got to be. Sorry, Gary, I think you're going to come in a minute, but if there is a disclosure, there are going to be huge ramifications. You're going to play with people's belief systems.
Yeah.
There's the whole oil industry,
sure,
the pharmaceutical industry,
yeah,
all these massive money-making machines that are certainly could be redundant.
Yeah, well, I wrote an article, and I can't remember what it's called. It's on my website, presidentialufo.com, but it used to be called The 64 Reasons Why They've Decided Not to Tell You the Truth. And basically, I say that if you were on the other side and you got the briefing, if you were the president and they came in and briefed you on the ramifications, I think I would do exactly what they're doing. I'm not on their side, so I'm not playing their game. But if you take a look at it, there are an awful lot of reasons why they want it covered up. And yet there is a division inside the highest ranks inside the U.S. government as to disclosure, no disclosure. They realize that eventually it's coming out. And so you want it out without spilling the milk, because once you spill the milk, you can't bring it back in. So you control the story. You never get a legitimate document or a legitimate photograph or a piece of metal or whatever. They control all that stuff, but you get the indirect stuff that they want us to talk. They're happy when Gary talks. They're happy when I talk about it. They love it, as long as you don't have a concrete piece of stuff that can prove that it's for real. And I think they're still divided. They want it out, but they still don't want it out. And there's this division as to when it's going to come out, how they bring it out. And
I think there is a real problem associated with disclosure, because as and when and if that does happen, there's going to be an awful lot of people with egg on their faces when this story comes out. And it will really be, you've been lying to us for 60-odd years.
The job straight away.
But do you see what I mean? But in the end, there's going to be an awful lot of people quite angry for a time that they've been lied to by governments, successive governments, administrations, etc., when people have been actively ridiculed through a campaign that was publicly put together by the Robertson Programme in 1953 that basically said we'll actively engage with the media to dumb down the subject. They've ridiculed pilots, police officers, and people have probably committed suicide out of this. And they've created this environment,
mm-hmm,
where people don't want to come forward. And the principal reason with police officers, with me, the two reasons about police officers approaching me is, one, they fear ridicule.
Yeah.
Why is their ridicule associated with very credible people who've made reports over the years? And two, an active fear that they're going to get labelled a UFO nut and it's going to affect their career. And these are important psychological things that the media and governments have allowed to happen,
yep,
that are actually wrong. They've ridiculed people who are credible people. And I can honestly say in 10 years of my research as an active UFO researcher that overwhelmingly the 98% of the people who contact me, within seconds I realise that these people are sincere. Because,
yeah,
I get a lot of civilians, yep, contacting me. And within seconds you just know that this is a real retrieval of information. They're logical people. I thought it was a plane. I thought it was a helicopter. They go through all the logical
processes. They've obviously done some work already, been trying to work out what it could be.
Absolutely.
You know, usually before they even contact.
Absolutely. You know, so when somebody takes the trouble to actually ring in, whether it be a police force, a Ministry of Defence, an RAF station, that's a big hurdle, because they know already that they're probably walking into ridicule. So when police officers do come forward, I've had doctors say, I want to come forward, I've had an experience, I've had architects, with big practices who want to come forward, and they go, I can't ever say anything to my colleagues, as my reputation's ruined, my business is ruined. Now that's a terrible state of affairs that society has created.
It's not right.
It's not right.
Isn't it true that pilots who see these on a regular basis, they're encouraged not to report these sort of things?
Absolutely. And in the past, there have been legislation kind of rules about disclosing information by pilots under the threat of fine. You know, these are actually not science fiction that we're making up. There have been sanctions against pilots. Pilots have had their careers ruined by going forward. And again, it's all because the powers that be, as it were, do not want this to come out, and it's been allowed to be perpetrated for well over 60 years.
Would you believe, though, that some information is put out in this drip-feeding process?
Absolutely.
Some control over the information being...
No. Grant is an expert at the political shenanigans, shall I say, of the way the machinations of CIA work and the NSA, NRO, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and he has got a great handle on it. And when you listen to his lecture today, it's all so clear that they put out some good stuff, they pull it away, they try to... But what they will do, which I find quite alarming, is they will... They're quite happy to burn, in a sense, UFO researchers. Not as in physically hurt, but what they do is they go to a reputation of somebody who's within the subject, they offer them this information, and if that researcher just puts it out blindly, hey, I've got this guy, I'm sorry, and then it's pulled, then there's egg on the face of the researcher, his credibility is gone, and they've done that. So you have to be very careful.
And they've done it a number of key times, like with Bill Moore, with Linda Howe. Like Linda Howe put out the first cattle mutilation documentary,
brilliant.
And she was immediately contacted and given a bunch of junk. And basically, it's if you get a researcher who is too credible, like Bill Moore when he came out with the Roswell book, or Linda Howe with the cattle mutilation, you suddenly become too credible. Then the major media starts listening to you, so you get material. Plus, you bring this person down a notch to take them away from being too credible and becoming somebody that people are actually going to listen to.
Well. Funnily enough, I won't go into detail because I've not got enough information at the moment, but in light of what Grant was saying in his lecture, I recounted some information that came from a source, a potential source that could be earth-shattering, as it were, in a major breakthrough for the Rendlesham case. And without going into detail, I asked a lot of questions, and this guy provided lots of very good information, which my inclination is that it's real, and if true, would be a major breakthrough. However, as soon as I started to press him on verifying who he was so that I'd be happy with him to keep him as a source, he's backed away. But in light of what Grant was saying, this could be an attempt to see how I deal with a major breakthrough piece of information.
You could be being tested,
I may be tested. I don't know, and I'm going to send the material to Grant.
Well, clearly there must be many other officials out there that have witnessed this and not come forward yet.
Absolutely. I think it's the tip of an iceberg. And I think if ever there was the green light, I think you'd have so many stories you wouldn't know where to turn.
I'm just going to mention as well, because some of our listeners might not be familiar with Rendlesham, but this is a UFO incident that happened in this country, which is, if not as big, possibly bigger than Roswell. And a lot of people, your average Joe public out there on the street, don't even know about it.
Absolutely, because the Rendlesham Forest story, whilst it's been heavily reported in the media, because it first emerged with the big news of the world spread in 1983, and it basically related to a document that had been written in January 1981 that's been called the Holt Memorandum, written by a guy called Lieutenant Colonel Holt, as he was then, retired colonel when he left the US Air Force. But basically that alluded to the fact that there'd been a landed object seen by US Air Force policemen, and it was in relation to Holt was the deputy base commander of what I know was a nuclear facility in Suffolk. And basically the third paragraph of this one-page precy, that's all it was, a little taster to the MOD, but the first paragraph dealt with the fact that there was a landed object, a triangular object, in the middle of a clearing seen by two US Air Force police officers. The second paragraph dealt with the actual ground impressions that were left, the equilateral triangle indentations to the same depth and width, depression, etc. And the fact that there was evidence of a blast area, there were broken branches where this object had broken through the canopy of the trees in the forest. And then the last paragraph, which for me is the key one, Holt himself, who was then the deputy base commander of this nuclear facility, actually says, well, I went out on another night and I saw multiple UFOs myself. Now, this is a lieutenant colonel in charge of a deputy base commander of a nuclear facility. It's not very often you get somebody of that ilk going on record saying he's personally seen UFOs himself. And this is why it's significant. And what's emerged later is that beams were shone down into the nuclear bunkers. Now, that has got to be of defence significance. Well, the MOD say there's nothing.
Can I just say, a lot of people, again, listening, and we all know Greenham Common, and this is something you mentioned in your lecture, but not many people know that these bases have probably held more nuclear weapons.
Well,
this isn't reported.
Well, if you spoke to Holt, Holt will do what any person will do who's been in the military. He'll say, I can neither confirm or deny.
but
that's what they do. Because the reality is, nobody is going to admit that there were nuclear weapons at that time. Because in the historical context of Rendlesham Forest, and this is missed, is There was a world crisis in December 1980. It was the Solidarnosc movement, Lech Walesa, the shipyards, the end of the Soviet era. It's just going to its dying phases of the Soviet Empire. And the Polish Solidarnosc situation was a threat to the Soviet Union. And the Politburo was obviously split. So they started to amass hundreds of thousands of troops on the Polish border, ready to go in like they've done into Hungary. And in the end, they didn't. And we wonder why not. And I think the UFOs came to Rendlesham because they realised that there were nuclear weapons that shouldn't have been there, that had maybe been there, placed there strategically in case there was a kind of a conflict.
I bet their intelligence is really good, isn't it? You know, the resources.
Yeah. Well, I honestly conclude that it's a well-known fact throughout UFO history. Over the last 60 years, there's a strong association with UFOs being seen outside nuclear facilities, power plants, etc. I do believe that it's not a mistake that they've turned up after the atom bomb.
That connection wasn't made straight away, but when people now go back and research where incidents took place, they start to find exactly where...
Oh, there's lots of things I think will still tie up in time. Mm. I think we will have to rewrite history when it does emerge.
We've got the news fast approaching.
I think we will have to rewrite history when the news emerges. That's an understatement. What I'd like to do today is... Because the petition is gaining momentum, I want to share with you some information from Jose Escamilla. He made a film. He uploaded 900 and some odd, almost 1,000 photos from NASA's website when they were available of I forgot the name of the mission. They had sent an imaging machine to the moon and took all these photos and made them public. So he uploaded them, and then he produced a film. And his work is pretty important. Let's say what Jose has to tell us about the structures on the moon. This is what NSA has been working with all these years. And they've been doing it with... commissioned by our shadow government, the one who hasn't told us anything about the dark things they've been doing. Here we go.
After I downloaded the 850 photographs of the moon in 2009, I started looking at the surface shots and became aware that there are many areas that appear to resemble oceans. While viewing celestial, you will start seeing what appear to be large structures seemingly underwater. It's like looking at a small pond, and underneath you see huge rocks that are discernible, but you can't see them clearly. This is how I found many of the structures you will see in the film. The Sea of Tranquility, as an example, was named that for a reason. Many of the blue areas were called mares, which in Latin and Spanish means seas or oceans. I'm not claiming there are vast oceans up there, but you get that visual sense when seeing things that appear underneath some kind of haze in these vast areas. The next section deals with the structures inside craters. I started by looking at the Apollo 17 photo to get ideas from my script. While I was reviewing the Apollo 17 photograph of the structure at the Lobachevsky crater, I noticed something very unusual I had never seen before. Right next to Lobachevsky, there's another crater called Geo. Resting at the lower rim of this crater is what looks like a fish-shaped object that has two separate fins at its tail. I immediately had to find out the size of this crater and this thing that's resting there. Geo is a 92-kilometer or 57-mile in diameter crater, which is slightly larger than Lobachevsky, so this thing laid across the crater three times must be at least 20 miles long, and who knows how wide it is. But it is quite unique, to say the least. I then started looking for as many Geo crater photos I could find. I Googled Geo crater, and I found something that really made my day. I clicked on the images section, and I saw photos that were mistaken for Geo, but that were of Lobachevsky, taken in 1972. There is this other photo of Lobachevsky in mistaken identity, and someone else had found an object sort of floating at the excavation area of the rim. In all my research on the Apollo 16 and 17 photos, I have never seen this one. I credit this find to the Real UFOs website out of Australia. In this photo, there appears to be an object hovering at the excavation site. There is no tower with the cross in the excavation section, so it makes me wonder, is this how the excavation was done? Is this a type of machine that does this on such a grand scale? Remember, the Lobachevsky structure is about 10 miles wide. So by looking for Geo, I found this, and it has to be what did the excavation. So this really made my day. I started searching for this new Apollo photograph. I Googled Geo and found another NASA website. So I clicked on the next link below the photos, and there it is. I found it. However, this NASA website says this is AS-16-121-19407. And I thought, this can't be. In the full-color photo, you can see the tower and the cross, but in the new photo that we found, there is nothing there except for this newfound anomaly. After reviewing the high-res full-color photo and this newfound photograph, I think the tunnel with the mound was misidentified by me. In the full-color close-up, you can see this object and its true color, which has this metallic-looking area at the front with a beige texture to it. The reason I didn't catch it at first is because of my mind's eye. I have never seen this type of shape before. It looked like a metallic mound to me because a mound is a shape I am used to seeing and that I easily mistook in the color photo. However, in the high-res black and white photo, the tower and the cross have disappeared, and now it looks way different. When comparing both the full color and this black and white image, both are different. So the jury is still out on the tower and the cross between these two photos. Looking at the aerial view of the same object at Lobachevsky, it does have some type of tower at its opening, so we'll just leave this as it is. What is awe-inspiring is that we may have found what was excavating this area at the time the Apollo 16 photo was taken. Curtis Hedges asked me, how could we have missed this one? And the truth is, because it was listed as Geo Crater, had I not caught that fish-looking object resting at the lower area of Geo Crater, this incredible new find would have escaped us. I thank NASA for misidentifying Geo for Lobachevsky because this is how it was found. So now back to the fish-looking object that brought us to Geo Crater. After seeking out more photos of Geo, I did not find any. The only photo that comes up in various sites is a Lobachevsky crater, AS-16-121-19407. And it is showing up on other NASA websites. This has become highly suspicious for me because why would this misidentification between Lobachevsky and Geo exist? It just doesn't make sense that there would be such a huge mix-up of these two craters. After searching for a decent Geo photo, I figured out there aren't any to compare with Apollo 17 to see if this fish-like object is or was there before and after the Apollo 17 photo was released. I continued by doing a before and after search of the Apollo 17 mission photos. These are before and after photos of Lobachevsky. I searched the Apollo 17 color film magazines for a considerable amount of time. I stopped editing on the film to find this elusive Geo photo, and I found this interesting other photo of the Lobachevsky crater, allegedly taken on December 1972. The photo is AS-17-151-23172. It is in color, but what is interesting is that it shows the structure as it appears in the Clementine color photo 22 years later. It's finished. It says this was taken on the second revolution of the mission from an altitude of 126 kilometers, or 78 miles, which is a very close shot. We know that the original Apollo 17 photo, AS-17-150-23085, was taken during revolution number 29 of the mission, also from a distance of 78 miles. But they are very different from each other. So either Apollo 17 went forward in time to capture what this structure looks like 22 years later, or there is another mix-up going on here with this important photography. after comparing the Apollo 17 photograph and the Clementine mission photograph, I can state, and you can quote me, both of these photographs are identical except for the glow at the bottom of the crater. In the 1972 photo, there is an object present, where in the Clementine photo, there is this glow, which is also present in the many photos of Lobachevsky you will be shown. In researching these photos, I have come to the conclusion that we know nothing about any of the moon missions and whether or not any of the photographs are recent or taken in the past. Because of my trying to make a comparison of the original Apollo 17 photo by finding another photo of Crater Geo to see if this fish-like object was a permanent fixture or something that was there for a moment, I have now come across this new mystery of the photography dealing with Lobachevsky and Geo. I don't know what to think anymore about this. One thing seems to have led to another, and now we have this issue about the structure in the Apollo 17 photograph. How could these two photographs be so identical to each other, supposedly taken 22 years apart? It was already an incredible find knowing the structure was built in 8 months, or so it seems. Now we have before us some kind of serious cover-up with this discrepancy between the newly found Apollo 17 photo and the Clementine photo from 22 years later. There seems to be something we just found out that tells us these images are way beyond us knowing when they were really taken. This is just another example of what I feel is one of the greatest stories ever denied the human public. Is this full-color photograph taken of Lobachevsky during the Apollo 11 mission, when we first landed on the moon, the match to the Apollo 17 photograph? There are huge discrepancies going on with the moon photographic archives that have been released to the public. There is no telling what is in the real photography of the moon, and unless we get there to see for ourselves, it seems we will never know the truth. I can only imagine what else they know, and what they have done to keep us dumbed down. You, the public, need to understand that the moon is right there. It is perhaps like another planet. There are so many things and structures there, as you are going to see, that you need to take hold of yourselves and start questioning why we've been misled for all these years and who is behind this. The most important question is why.
I have no earthly idea why astronomers don't show it in all its glory.
So I spent at least 8 hours looking through each and every 70mm Hasselblad photo magazines from Apollo 4 to Apollo 17, searching for that elusive Geo photograph that would answer whether or not that fish-like object is a fixture of Geo, or in fact something else that was only there for the Apollo 17 photo. I looked for the fish-like object in the Clementine color photography, and it is nowhere to be seen. Such a large object, if it was a geological formation of some kind, would still be there, and because of its size, would be seen from high above as the structure that can be seen in the Lobachevsky crater. As with all things you seek out, you eventually hit pay dirt. And so here it is. I finally found the elusive crater Geo. So here it is, AS16-M-1318. And guess what? There is no fish-like object there. I found this in the Apollo 16 metric photography. This brings us to the moon craters that have mysterious-looking objects and structures within them. When you see this photography from the Clementine research, you can go to any NASA website and start comparing what you are about to see. In fact, I urge you to start looking at what has been published. You will soon find out, as I have, that many of the photographs that exist and are available for review are way different. The structures you're about to see are not in other photographs. This either means they have been removed or airbrushed out, or they were not yet constructed when the original photos were taken. These are the only two options that come to mind. These incredible crater anomalies are from the Clementine color photography taken in 1994. I would love to get my hands on the full color photography taken by China recently to compare with the Clementine photos. On the near side of the moon, there are interesting craters we found that have structures within them. This requires us to zoom out and see where we're going to go so you can get a perspective. We'll start with Aristarchus because it is the most prominent crater on the near side of the moon. When you look at this area from about 170 miles away, you can see a major portion of the near side of the moon. We move to the west to a crater known as Seleucus. Moving on Seleucus, we find this crater has some very interesting features. First of all, at the top of the rim of the crater can be seen what appear to be tower-like structures. There are other anomalies going on in this area, such as what appear to be large tubing on the right side of the crater. These are curved and seemingly stretching across the rim of the crater in that area. There are other craters that had these types of tubing along the rims. Continuing down the near side of the moon, we come to a very large crater called Marius, which is located at the center area. The striking features inside this crater appear to be that it has a dome over it, and inside are mounds that have a donut hole in their center. These mounds appear all over the surface of the moon, both the near and far side areas. There's this one anomaly close to this crater, and it seems to be something coming out of a cave. It's not shaped like a crater, and there's another one of these in this area. And I am not going to say they are flying, but you can be the judge of that. They are certainly anomalous objects on the moon. Going back to the crater, we move southward. Passing all these amazing, colorful, and very busy landscapes, we get to a very large crater, which will be our focus crater for this region. It's called Gassendi, and it is situated atop Mare Humorum. At the bottom of Mare Humorum, I found these two very interesting craters that you can see have massive structures within them. This one crater called Vitello seems to have the dome portion broken, or it might have caved in. You can tell the glass-like dome portion is broken. A very interesting thing happened here to cause this damage, and we don't have a clue as to the historical record involved in this dome being damaged. The crater is 26 miles in diameter. Moving slightly away to the left, we come upon crater Doppelmayr, which is 39 miles in diameter and almost a mile deep. There is no doubt this dome has an interior full of giant buildings and structures within the base of the crater. There appear to be some square buildings, and this tall structure has what appears to be the number 2 along its side. Again, you have to look at the sizes of these structures. They are massive. Moving to the right of the crater Vitello, I found this crater called Ramsden. There appears to be a glass or some kind of translucent dome over it. It protrudes upward. The sun is glistening off this area, and you can see some green areas within it. You can see some structures in there. When we zoom out a little further, you can plainly see this is in fact a dome-shaped structure. The crater is 15 miles in diameter and a little over a mile deep. Here we have a dome on the moon with some kind of environment going on that was built by somebody. In the last few minutes, I have shown you some very incredible and massive structures. What you're about to see next is what I consider one of the most incredible and mysterious structures I have ever seen on the moon. When I say this, you have to know it means a lot for this structure to surpass what we have just seen.
To give you an idea on how big some of these structures are on the moon compared to the structures here on Earth, let's begin with the tallest statues in the world. This is a comparison in sizes for you to learn. Christ the Redeemer that rests atop a mountain in Rio de Janeiro is 39.6 meters or 130 feet tall. Next is the Motherland Calls, located in Russia, which stands 91 meters or 298 feet tall from the tip of the sword to ground level. Then we have the Statue of Liberty, standing at 93 meters or 300 feet tall. The tallest statue of them all is the Spring Temple Buddha in China, standing at 153 meters or 503 feet tall. All of these architectural marvels were made by humans here on Earth. As an example of the time it took to make these statues, the Statue of Liberty took 21 years to be transformed from an idea to a copper and steel statue that graces New York's harbor. Let's revisit Aristarchus. It is 25 miles in diameter and has a depth of 12,000 feet or 2.25 miles. When you compare this crater to the surrounding structures, such as the one that resembles an eel with its mouth open, you have to realize that the structure is massive. It's about a third of the size of Aristarchus. Who has the technology to build such a structure, and what does it mean? What is its purpose? The pyramids are wonders we can't explain. But here you have a statue that is massive. Because there is no data anywhere on any NASA website or journals about this statue, we don't have an accurate measurement as to its size, so we had to rely on good old-fashioned comparisons with known objects that we know its measurements. We took the aerial photo of both the statue and Aristarchus from about 170 miles above. We isolated the two areas in identical size squares, then we put them side by side without manipulating their sizes. Next, we enlarged both squares by enhancing the brightness on the square with the statue. You can now see it a little better. We then isolated the statue and copied and pasted onto the crater and stacked them on top of each other. It took four statues piled up to fill the diameter of the crater. So by looking at this and knowing the diameter of the crater being 25 miles, this means 25 miles divided by 4 gives us an estimate size of the statue being approximately 6.25 miles tall. Again, without the exact measurements, we just don't know, but it's taller than the tallest statue here on Earth. This 6-mile-tall statue, seen side by side with the tallest statue on the Earth, dwarfs them in size by miles. On the subject of objects and structures that appear to be underwater, here's a perfect example. We have this statue, and near it, you can see what appears to be a monument of some kind. maybe a building or steps leading up to an entrance. We don't know how else to describe these massive structures. Someone built or sculpted the statue, but how? How in the world can anyone sculpt a statue miles high and miles wide? Here on Earth, it's impossible. Yet on the moon, there it is, something very large that resembles a type of humanoid unlike us. So if the statue on the moon is 6.25 miles tall, which is not an impossibility, you have to imagine whoever built the moon statue was capable of doing the impossible.
This film is absolutely astounding. If you want a real treat, the entire film, 55 minutes, called Celestial, is on YouTube. Go and look at these pictures. It's dumbfounding. If you just type in Jose and Moon, you're going to find this guy's work. It's astounding. Now I'd like to share with you a short article. This is Carl Wolf's accounting of the structures on the moon. The following account has been addressed several times before, and I've had it in my notes for quite some time. The recent interest in the space program and questions about our future goals in space have caused me to dust it off. I believe it will be of interest to our viewers. This extraordinary story comes to us from one Carl Wolf. Wolf worked for the Director of Intelligence at Headquarters Tactical Air Command Technical Group. The fantastic events explained here occurred while he was stationed at Langley Field, Virginia. That's the headquarters of the CIA. Langley Field was a center for information received from the Lunar Orbiter Project. Satellite receivers from around the world waited for information from the orbiter. And it was then channeled to Langley, where the information was transferred into photographic images and other top secret data. The photographic imaging was done at a secure military lab ran by NSA, inside CIA. In an interview for UFO Magazine, Wolf asserted that he was one of only two technicians at Langley with high enough security clearance to work with the high-tech photographic equipment, which processed info from U-2 spy planes and other military intelligence hardware. This is Wolf speaking in his own words. At any rate, I was in a color lab one day when my boss, Staff Sergeant Taylor, came over to me and said they were having a problem with some equipment on the base, and it was the first lunar orbiter program, where they had a mission to pretty much locate the first landing sites of the 1969 lunar mission for the astronauts. So he said they were having some problem with the equipment over there. It was similar equipment to what we had. It was computerized contact printing equipment. He wanted to know if I would go over and take a look at it. He said to me, "It's an NSA facility." At the time, I didn't know what NSA was. I was pretty naive. Remember, everybody, NSA, National Security Agency. These were the operatives that were with Dick Cheney when he set off 9/11. I thought he said NASA. So in my mind, for a long time, I thought it was NASA, a NASA facility I had gone to, but I remembered him saying NSA and converting it into my own mind to NASA. Wolf claims that one day when NSA photographic equipment failed, he was called in to assist them with the critical repair work needed to keep the machines on the job. Coincidentally, Wolf was the only individual available at the time trained in the type of equipment that had failed. He normally would be crossing lines by venturing into NSA territory. His security clearance status was raised to enable him to even enter the highly secure laboratory. Wolf's heart raced as he entered the heretofore forbidden hangar that day, and he was shocked to see the frantic activity in the lab, activities carried out by individuals of many different nations. Wolf had naturally thought only American citizens would be in the NASA lab, but there were many individuals with guest name tags on, and obviously from foreign countries present this day, inferring that they were there on a temporary basis for some special occasion. He felt a sense of panic as to his mission. Whatever he was called in for was the utmost importance. He was told that the equipment in question was in a nearby dark room. As he was led into the room, only the red glow of a safety light greeted him at first. But in a moment, he could make out the figure of one airman who manned the dark room. Wolf knew that the image processing equipment would have to be removed to be repaired, and he also knew that the diagnostics on this type of equipment would take some time to finish. Arrangements were quickly made for the photographic equipment to be taken to another secure location for Wolf to begin the painstaking task of troubleshooting the problem. As Wolf waited for transport to arrive, he began to chat with the other airmen. Wolf carefully asked why the NASA work was being done at Langley and not NASA in Houston. It was then that he was told that all of the NASA image information was downloaded to Langley, enhanced, and made into the finished photographs that were then studied by different branches of the armed forces. The darkroom attendant began to explain to Wolf just what the secrecy was about. Wolf was told that recent enhanced images had surprisingly yet clearly shown structures on the surface of the dark side of the moon, structures that definitely were not created by natural means, such as meteors or ancient collisions with other heavenly bodies. The structures were created by intelligent beings. "We discovered," the airman said, "a base of the backside of the moon." Wolf was obviously stunned by this extraordinary disclosure. He remembers literally shaking, trying to take in the enormity of what he had been told. Seeing Wolf's disbelief, the darkroom attendant continued, "Yes, a base on the dark side of the moon." Although the attendant had not actually said that the structures were not created by inhabitants of Earth, it seemed to go without saying. Wolf was still in amazement as he was now looking down at the very photographs he was trying to envision in his mind. Bending down under the red glowing lamp, he was seeing what was so very few would see. He could clearly make out geometric shapes, well organized and well designed. Most noticeable to him were what looked exactly like radar antennas, very similar to what one would see on Earth. There was no doubt now in Wolf's mind why the odd complement of scientists and investigators were in attendance at this place on this day. They had arrived to see and study what he was looking at now, structures made by intelligent beings on the moon. Questions flooded his mind now. Could Russia have made these structures, putting the first flag on the lunar surface? Could this be a joint venture of some kind? If so, by whom? Americans and aliens? Whomever was the creator, Wolf felt, like he had been caught stealing, or with his hand in the cookie jar. He was not supposed to see these photographs. He could be arrested or worse. He just wanted to do his job, leave, and never mention it again. Wolf did finish the job he was commissioned to do, keeping the memories of that day dormant in his mind, and went on with his life. Wolf, however, was haunted by the images he saw that day for many years to come, and he left the active service. His security clearance prohibited him from leaving the United States for 5 years, and he was sworn to keep what he had seen to himself. It would be 30 years before he told anyone about that unforgettable day. For the year that Wolf saw the remarkable structures on the dark side of the moon was 1965, 4 years before Neil Armstrong put his first footprint on the lunar surface. Or was it the first? So, for some of you, this is new information, and for some of you, it's old hat, and you've known it a lot longer than I did. The point is that we have to end the truth embargo. It's time now. So, what I'd like to do now, everybody, is share a meditation. And so I'm looking for one to share. Here I have an oldie but a goodie. I wrote this at the time the Avatar movie came out. Here we go. Enjoy this.
No time.
Hold on, I have to start.
Hello, this is Beth from the Galactic Roundtable. I wrote this meditation for you to meet your twin flame at the Tree of Souls. So please join me now for meditation. As you enter this meditation, you leave the tonal world and enter the Nagual world. Please allow yourself to take a few deep breaths and slowly disconnect from the world of form. Every time you come here, you experience love frequency and allow your body vibration to speed up its light. Allow the issues of this day to fall away. Allow your body response to come back to neutral. It is neutrality where we find absence of ego mind and devote ourselves to loving all that is without reservation. Take in a deep breath and release it slowly and feel your heartbeat slow down a little bit and feel yourself relaxed. We're going to take a journey forward in time. We are going to time out of time. We call this place no time. We are going to a place where we all know we are one. We are going to where the magical kingdoms are living free on Earth. Mother and she has been restored to pristine beauty. Now see pink clouds in a blue sky. The sun is shining and feels good. Now take off flying in your avatar body. Fly over the lush green trees below. Feel the wind in your face as you breeze past the floating mountains on your banshee. The misty fog just above the treetops is refreshing. Then again, you feel bright sun on your face. Now, jump off and land easily on a green leaf. Feel the veins of the leaf under your feet. Feel the heartbeat of the tree through its veins. It feels exhilarating to remember the tree is alive and it communicates bliss with knowing you through the touch sensors and the veins in the bottom of your feet touching its veins in the green silk of the leaf. You turn then and see you are standing near the Tree of Souls. Then you see standing there next to the Tree of Souls is your own twin flame. You are so happy to meet them here. They too are in their avatar body. You walk slowly, feeling the damp moss under your feet. When you take a step, the green moss turns pink from the pressure of your foot. The moss lights up as it is happy to see you. Just then, a small seedling from the Tree of Souls floats near your face. This delights you, and you sigh at the sight of the hair-like tendrils floating up like a blue jellyfish. The tiny seed floats lightly, brushing your arm with divine bliss before floating out over the tops of the glowing magenta flowers. And your heart beats a little faster, remembering your connection to all life here. You get closer to the Tree of Souls and greet your twin flame standing there. Your twin flame takes you by the shoulders and brings their face close to your face. And you stare deeply into each other's eyes. The long leaves of the Tree of Souls stretch down to the ground just before you. And these leaves glow white, violet, pink. And this light hits the face of you and your twin flame as you embrace. It is silent here except for your breath, and you can hear the tree. You can hear the heartbeat of the tree. The energy here is magnified because the roots of this tree reach out infinitely over Mother Earth, and you can feel the connection to every mountain peak every blade of grass, every fish in the sea, just by standing here under this sacred tree. The glowing, swaying leaves light up the gaze of your love as they stare tenderly at you. At this moment, you are filled up completely with joy, with bliss, and with love. You sit with your twin flame under the Tree of Souls now, and Mother Sekhmet comes to join you and sits next to you. Mother Sekhmet says, "Greetings, children of Ra. To come back to this place is to come back to our origins together on Earth. This is a place where the magical kingdoms are free to be as they are unhindered. The plants grow in harmony with each other. You may sip the rain from the end of a giant leaf when you are thirsty. When you are hungry, fruit is abundant at your feet. Energy is something that is borrowed and must be returned. Life flows in and out, and out and in. In as a pulse. Energy flows as naturally as the sun rising. It flows from one tree to the next and on, circling the globe. The flying ones, the crawling ones, and the swimming ones live together as one. Here the dreamwalkers know peace, and hearts overflow with radiant love for all life forms. Drink in this time together. Allow Mother Earth's pulse flow through your veins. Soar above the treetops, through the mountains, and be one with all that is. Rise up into your light bodies. Float up higher and higher through the dimensions until you are a ball of light. Come together with your twin flame, who is a ball of light beside you. Overlap and merge your light together, making a rainbow ball of white light. Float on into the sun and float through the bubble in the sun. There you merge with Mother Sekhmet and Father Alcyone as one light. They read your desires and answer your calls, and you float back together to the Tree of Souls, where all on earth is one, and you know this merge with each other and with the great central sun has lifted you to a place of infinite bliss. You take this feeling as you fly back through the misty floating mountains, back into your body, back to the spot on this timeline. Please visit this place in meditation again and again until it is your reality and you come to a place where all time is no time."
Thank you, everybody, for joining me here today. Please go out and let's add up those signatures on that petition. Thank you for all you do. Have a wonderful day, and please come see me again tomorrow. Namaste.